Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's threat to shut down the government in order to get his border wall and compare that act of stupidity to the monumental catastrophe which failing to raise the debt ceiling would be, with the United States defaulting on its debt and ruining its full faith and credit as the world's best bet and the place to invest your money. Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and a member of President Obama's economic team, joins us to explain the vastly different degrees of a self-inflicted wound a default would be compared to a government shutdown. We will assess the hope that there are some adults in the room who could constrain a reckless and ignorant president in league with the nativist ideologues of the Tea Party House Freedom Caucus, whose economic illiteracy is only surpassed by their xenophobic zeal to wall off America from the Latino and Muslim hordes. Then we will speak with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest, about his latest book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. We will discuss Trump's alarming response to the recent disgrace of neo-Nazis descending on Thomas Jefferson's hometown and Jefferson's warning that, quote, an ignorant people cannot remain a free people in the context of a failing education system and growing civic ignorance compounded by social media that has given rise to our Kardashian culture. Then finally, we'll examine the Secretary of the Interior's plan to review 27 national monuments ordered by President Trump that threatens to open up federal land protected under the Antiquities Act to mining, logging, drilling, and grazing. Robert Kider, the founding director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah and the author of To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea, joins us to discuss the likelihood that a blizzard of lawsuits will ensue if Trump is to be the first ever president to abolish a national monument designated by a predecessor. And joining us now is Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and a member of President Obama's economic team. And prior to joining the Obama administration, he was a senior economist and the director of the Living Standard Program at the Economic Policy Institute. And before that was deputy chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
And I think it'd be useful for the public to get a kind of primer on what's at stake here when just a couple of days ago at a campaign-style rally in Arizona, President Trump told the crowd, believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall. And of course, he's referring to the border wall that 6 in 10 people in the United States oppose, with 85% of Americans saying that Mexico is not going to pay for that wall, as Trump promised. Ultimately, we would be picking up the tab. So let's talk about the difference between shutting down the government and defaulting, which is really what we should be talking about.
Right. Well, the idea of a government shutdown is a very very bad idea, in no small part because the economy's doing pretty well. Still got room to run, no question. But the idea of any kind of own goal, as they say in soccer, that is doing something foolish for a particularly bad reason in this case, is just pointless. When we've had these government shutdowns in the past, they've ended up being temporary, but also wasteful and somewhat costly. So, for example, the national park shut down, and that means there's less economic activity. People postpone or cancel trips therein. An interesting wrinkle that people may not know about is when the government shuts down, a bunch of employees go home, but eventually they end up getting paid anyway for work that they didn't do. So it's just a really dumb way to waste a few billion dollars, depending on how long the shutdown goes on for.
So your metaphor you use, though, it would seem to me that as opposed to an own goal in SOFCA, if we were to default on our debt, then that would be akin not so much to shooting yourself in the foot, but shooting yourself in the head.
Right, right. Numerous times. The idea that the U.S. would default on its sovereign debt, meaning that the debt held by the public, I'm talking about all the treasury bonds that are out there, when payments come due on those, as well as all kinds of other obligations that the government has. If the government were to not meet those obligations because of this whole debt ceiling problem, that would be a default. Now, defaults do happen, but not in advanced economy governments, and especially governments that can print their own currency. So this really makes absolutely no sense at all. What would happen to the economy? I mean, we don't know, because thankfully we've never done this before, and hopefully there'll be enough grown-ups in the room to take over this time so we won't do it again. So we won't do it this time. But of course, interest rates would shoot up dramatically. That is, the amount of money that lenders want to get from you when they lend you money, that's very much a function of credit risk or the likelihood that you would default. Obviously, if we would default, credit risk would go through the roof, interest rates would shoot up. Now, we have a stock of public debt in this country that comes to about $15 trillion. So let's say the interest rate went up one measly point. Now, that's way optimistic. It would probably go up many multiples of that. But let's just say the interest rate went up one point. Well, on a stock of $15 trillion of debt, that's $150 billion. And that's $150 billion more dollars of debt service. It's like 0.75% of GDP, just because Congress can't get its act together and the president is playing ridiculous risky games.
And again, I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, the senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and a member of President Obama's economic team. So, but this is more than a game, it would seem. If you look at the latest tweet that came out on Thursday morning from President Trump, and that is the means by which he transacts policy by tweeting about it. He said, I requested that Mitch M, meaning the majority leader of the Senate, and Paul R, meaning the Speaker of the House, tie the debt ceiling legislation to the popular VA bill, which just passed, for easy approval. They didn't do it. So now we have a big deal with Dems holding them up as usual on debt ceiling approval. Could have been so easy, now a mess. So what do you take from that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would urge you and your listeners not to take anything Donald Trump says or tweets as verbatim or even that seriously in many cases. So he may say something in the morning and completely reverse himself in the evening. So he's always negotiating, he's always posturing, he's often lying. So you just can never know what to make out of these things. And we've been here before, and there is a way out. There are enough kind of grown-ups at the table, members of Congress who consider default just as absolutely crazy as I do, and they will raise the debt ceiling at the last minute, as they've done in the past, as is the way we hope this ends. Now, by no means am I saying that the probability of defaulting is zero. It's non-zero, but based on history, it's pretty low. Let me make another point, though, about this. This is really important. The objection to raising the debt ceiling comes from obstructionists, people who don't understand economics, politicians who want to make a lot of noise, maybe get themselves in the newspaper, maybe look good to their constituents who also don't really understand the economic dynamics of what's going on here. So they make a big deal about how raising the debt ceiling is inconsistent with fiscal responsibility. That is completely misguided in the following sense. The reason we need to raise the debt ceiling is to pay for all of the spending that Congress has already authorized. This is not for new spending. This is for spending that these members of Congress, who are currently, some of them, arguing that we shouldn't raise the debt ceiling or we should have a default in order rather than give up a clean debt ceiling bill. They are perfectly akin to someone sitting at a restaurant who just finished their meal and they're wiping their greasy face with their napkins and saying, I'm not going to pay that bill. It's perfectly analogous because, again, this is spending that they've already signed off on. So it's not fiscally responsible. It's fiscally reckless.
Well, the president, I think, is in that category of not knowing what is at stake here. But my understanding is that if the United States defaults, in terms of the shooting yourself in the head analogy, this would be like shooting yourself in the head with a nuclear weapon. Because wouldn't this affect one of the greatest advantages the U.S. has, with the dollar being the global reserve currency?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, it's again, as I said earlier, it's really hard to say what would happen because we've not even, it's not that we haven't defaulted, it's that we've always been considered the safest haven. Our government debt has and is to this day, as I speak to you, is considered by far the safest asset in the world. Putting Trump in the last 6 months aside, that's because we have a stable democracy, liquid capital markets, the rule of law, a court system, a Federal Reserve that oversees a banking system. And it doesn't mean that everybody does their job perfectly and that we never have hiccups or much worse. Of course, we do. But the reputation of U.S. sovereign debt is the highest in the world. And to lose that would be cataclysmic. I cited the cost in terms of debt service because interest rates would go through the roof. But each year, the government contracts something like $500, $600 billion in outside contracts, worth of contracts. So would we not pay the members of the military? Would we not pay the people who provide their food and lodging? Would we not pay the many employees of the government sector? Would we not send out Social Security checks? Would we stop providing Medicare? I mean, these are the kinds of existential questions that would be invoked by this kind of thing.
Well, just in closing, Jared Bernstein, my understanding is that already Wall Street's unsettled by this even talk of a government shutdown and a default. So I don't think you can dismiss this because we've never had a president like Donald Trump. We've never had, 6 or 7 months of chaos like this, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. And the announcement that he made about threatening to shut down the government to get his border wall came in a speech that many people consider was completely unhinged.
Well, before we go on, let me distinguish between a government shutdown and a default on our debt, as we have throughout our conversation. Now, mm-hmm. They're not the same thing, right. And the latter is many multitudes worse than the former. Neither are good, neither are necessary, neither are needed. I can definitely see Trump trying to shut down the government. I'm not sure he'd go as far as defaulting, but I'm not sure he wouldn't.
Well, that's not entirely comforting, is it?
No, it isn't.
All righty. Well, thank you for joining us, and let's try and stay in touch here as the wrecking
much.
Crew continues. And again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and a member of President Obama's economic team. And prior to joining the Obama administration, he was a senior economist and the director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute. And before that was deputy chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual, Henry Giroux.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound.
A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound.
Is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound. That makes the world go round. Money, 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 money.
From the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Henry. And let's start with the broadest possible landscape, in the sense that, are we still a democracy? Have we crossed the Rubicon into plutocracy? Because it seems to me that you could make the case that not just plutocrats run America, but just three plutocrats seem to dominate our government. The two Koch brothers obviously have the Congress doing their bidding, and we have one billionaire, Robert Mercer, and his daughter, who seem to, at least they're the biggest donors to Trump and clearly have some influence over him. So where would you place us in that sense, whether we're still a democracy?
No, I don't think we're a democracy at all. I mean, I think that, and what's increasingly disturbing about the fact that we're no longer a democracy is that there's no longer an attempt to defend the notion that we might be a democracy. I mean, I think that what we have seen increasingly over the past few years, and especially under Trump, is a switch in the language. And it's a switch that speaks to the need to define, in some ways, democracy without any substance. And I think that, in other words, there's no attempt, there's increasingly less of an attempt to justify what we see in terms of policies, or what we see in terms of ideology, or what we see in terms of social practices in the name of democracy. Trump rarely ever mentions the word democracy, as you well know. It's almost completely absent from his speeches. And I think that what we're seeing in Trump is evidence of what we're witnessing all over the world, which is a worldwide rejection of liberal democracy itself. And I think that it's being replaced with a kind of populist authoritarianism that is, in a sense, very comfortable now with defining itself precisely as that. So rather than saying it's a democracy, I mean, we're now saying, hey, look, we need strong rule, we need strong leaders, we need people basically who are going to preserve a sense of cultural nationalism. So all the markers for an anti-democratic society are now being touted in ways in which even the discourse of democracy is no longer used to legitimate those markers.
So, in other words, we've seen democracy be rolled back in the Philippines under Duterte, who's busily murdering people that he doesn't like. There's an example. Are we similar to the Philippines without extrajudicial murders going on?
I think that we're closer to places like Modi's India, and closer to Putin's Russia. I think that Orbán's Hungary, and Duda in Poland. I mean, I think that these countries are really similar to what we're seeing happening in the United States. I think that Duterte is the end point of the most extreme versions of this type of authoritarianism. But I think that when you have a president of the United States basically defending the actions of neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, Negroes and white and Charlottesville and white nationalists. I think you have to ask yourself, you know, in what way has the language changed so as to suggest that the very nature of power itself has changed? And I think in that sense, yeah, we are in that moment of populist authoritarianism, which is enormously dangerous. I mean, certainly we can't point to elections. I mean, I guess the real question might be, you know, what are the measures that you want to point to that suggest that a democracy even exists in this country? Do you want to point to elections? They're bought and sold. You know, you have the Koch brothers. I mean, you know, they don't believe in elections being democratic. I mean, the basic economic, political, and cultural institutions of the United States are now largely driven by corporations. You have the AFL-CIO leader actually joined a presidential commission under a guy who basically is as anti-labor as you can possibly get. So I guess the question here, where are the markers of democracy? I mean, how would you measure that now? How would you talk about democracy outside of certain limited freedoms that basically are as empty as the word itself?
Well, the countries that you mentioned that we're more like in terms of drift into authoritarianism, Hungary, Poland, and Russia, in all cases, the way that the country was essentially taken over by Putin and Orban and the Kaczynski brother, the first thing they did was take over the media. So we do seem to have a kind of ministry of truth in this country developing with Fox, and Murdoch apparently speaks to Trump almost every day. Sinclair is now about to be made even more powerful than it is, and will be in every home across the country just about. And then you've got these minor, lesser players like Breitbart and Drudge. And of course, you've got wackos like Alex Jones out there, who apparently the president actually believes and listens to. So is that an indicator in terms of what you're suggesting?
Yes, it is. And it's an important point that you're making, because I think at one level, what it suggests, if you compare those groups to other groups like the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know, one might say, well, wait a minute, you know, you do have this press that now is basically pushing back against Trump. But what Trump has done is that rather than simply shut down the media, he's discredited the media and harassed them to such a degree that in many ways he's convinced a large part of the American public that they're nothing more than an expression of fake news. I mean, he's done something actually more pronounced and, in my estimation, far more powerful than any of these other nations. I mean, he's created a tweet nation. This is a nation of tweet. And he excludes them. He excludes them through his tweets. He excludes them through a cultural war in which he realizes that the power of ideas don't always work simply in the interest of resistance. That ideas can be used to basically, in some way, create a kind of collective hysteria and massive sense of fear that results in many ways a shift in sympathies away from the call for democracy to the symbolic necessity of what we might call strongman leaders, authoritarian types like Trump. So I think in that sense, he's far more sophisticated. I think the United States is far more sophisticated in polluting what we might call the discourse of freedom, collaboration, and dissent.
Well, Donald Trump would never have been elected president in this country but for the $5 billion of free media that the mainstream media gave him. I'm sure they're trying to redeem themselves now, but that's an inescapable fact, is it not, Henry?
Well, I think it is an inescapable fact. Inescapable in the sense that they're trying to redeem themselves. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, that they gave him $5 billion worth.
Yeah, of course. And they readily admit that.
Yeah.
And they played a central role, of course, in Trump's election. But I think what that points to is, particularly in the United States, is that the economic crisis was never matched by a crisis of ideas. So that you didn't have, you know, alternative public spheres such as what you do and what others do, who were really able to expose Trump and all the contradictions for what he was worth, rather than playing into this politics of theatrics and distraction that really is what drives the press. I mean, the press, the corporate press, the mainstream press, is really about ratings. It's not about the search for truth. I mean, why is it that every reporter who's reading off a teleprompter today is 25 years old and looks as if they've just won a beauty contest somewhere? I mean, you know, it's pretty clear that politics has turned into a pathology that now organizes itself almost entirely around questions of money and aesthetics. It's a spectacle.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is also the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Now, of course, you mentioned Charlottesville, where the Nazis descended upon Thomas Jefferson's hometown recently. A young woman was murdered, and Trump, of course, said there were fine people on both sides, which he's obviously trying to get out from under that. He even lied about it the other night at a rally in Phoenix. It omitted what he'd really said. But what I find extraordinary, and particularly when I see these crowds, there's an African-American guy that's always been at all of his rallies. It's got an amazingly long rap sheet for all kinds of cult activities and capital crimes, and yet he shows up at every Trump event. This whole tawdry scene from day one is absolutely extraordinary, and to see him in this kind of bread and circuses mode. Even, by the way, even his own people started to drift off because he was just repeating himself like a madman. But it reminds me, given that Thomas Jefferson Town was recently, Charlottesville was invaded by the Nazis, that Jefferson famously said, "An ignorant people cannot remain a free people." And you're a specialist in pedagogy. Is that at the heart of our problem, is the collapse of public education?
I mean, I think you can't have a democracy without informed citizens, right? I mean, that's John Dewey. That's Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt said, if you really want to understand fascism, you have to understand something. It's really about what you call thoughtlessness. You know, the ability to create the conditions in which people lose their capacity to think and to be able to hold power accountable. And I think that, you know, just look at the recent statistics that have come out about the Republican Party that is shocking. I mean, almost 50% of all Republicans now believe that if Trump refused to hold elections in 2020, they would go along with that. Over 50% of all Republicans now believe that higher education is more of a curse than a benefit. Increasingly, in a number of Republican states, they're criminalizing the possibility of protest. Higher education is being defunded. Public schools are being privatized. The media basically, we have Betsy DeVos, who is really, you know, comparable to an idiot, you know, who's now running the Department of Education and hates public education. You have Jeff Sessions, you know, who is really the great white hope of white nationalists. And then, of course, you have this thing with Charlottesville and the kind of press that it gets. But what nobody wants to talk about is that you live in a country that is rooted in such ignorance that even the dream of the Confederacy never dies. That, you know, that's constantly being reproduced. Couple that with the war being waged against women, against young people, against transgender people, against gays, against labor, and the attack on education, and you begin to realize that people cannot basically translate private issues into larger public concerns. That's why this attack on education has been going on for over 40 years. 40 years. You can go right back to the Powell memo. When they were very, very clear, Lewis Powell was very clear writing for the Chamber of Commerce. He said if the right wants to win, it has to win the battle of ideas. And they understood that, and they built think tanks, and they built, you know, all these private institutions that now create their own public intellectuals. This is one of the few countries in the world in which most of the intellectuals we now hear in the media are anti-public intellectuals. They're not public intellectuals. They're anti-public intellectuals. And in some cases, especially under Trump, Ian, as you well know, especially a guy as sophisticated and as smart as you are, you know, you listen to these people talk, they're like babbling idiots. You think, oh, my God. I mean, you know, where do they find these people? I mean, do they have they should revoke their high school diplomas. I mean, these are people that are that stupid for whom the truth is meaningless. And that the real issue here is to create a fog of ignorance that would not enable people to, in a sense, act on their own sense of agency as critical citizens. And I think you're right. That's at the core of the problem. Now, you couple that with a celebrity culture that confers enormous authority in the country and mimics almost every aspect of neoliberal ideology. The competition, the rugged individualism, only one person left on the island, you know, this kind of warlike militancy that drives the collective fantasies, you know, these revenge fantasies that now sort of permeate every aspect of the culture. These are not just political issues. These are educational issues because they're really about the creation of particular kinds of subjects, subjects that are comfortable finding themselves living in an authoritarian society.
Well, that's the curse, I think, of social media. You could paraphrase Winston Churchill's Battle of Britain admonition: never before in the field of human activity has so much been said by so many about so little.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think for me as an educator and somebody who worked with Paulo Freire for over 20 years, and I remember he used to say, if you really want, in a sense, to create a culture of conformity and passivity and a culture of powerlessness, lead people to believe that they're responsible for their own problems, that there are no systemic problems, there are no larger social problems. Lead people to believe that the hopelessness and the despair that they find can only be solved in the image of some symbolic strongman who somehow will make up for their own deficiencies and all of a sudden then make the appeals and produce the ideologies necessary to turn what we might call protest into a kind of enormous rage and hatred that both is cleansing and at the same time employs the spectacle of violence.
Well, you've got the combination of social media and people retreating into their iPhones and not having any more human contact or less and less human contact. You've got education being destroyed by a two-front war, the libertarian Koch brothers on the one hand attacking public education out of their peculiar ideology, and then you've got Christian fundamentalists like Betsy DeVos who refer to public schools as government schools and feel that they indoctrinate kids into Marxism instead of teaching them Christianity and Genesis. And here in Los Angeles now, there are billboards all over the city celebrating, you know, against evolution, this anti-evolution idea of celebrating the book of Genesis. So it is a very peculiar time. But your new book, Henry Giroux, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, after having basically told us what is wrong, your books tells us what we can do. So let's walk through some of your points there, because I don't want to leave people in despair.
No. I think we have to remember something. I mean, you know, power is not simply about domination. You know, it's also about resistance. It's also about hope. It's also about, in some way, confronting the issues that we need to confront in order to basically not feel alone and isolated and to join with others to collectively address some of the issues that are bearing down on our lives. One of the good things that we see in the midst of all this ignorance is that, you know, there are many people who don't buy this. I mean, you know, you have especially young people. I mean, I'm just so enamored with the resistance I see collectively on the part of young people all over the country, you know, who refuse to buy this anti-gay nonsense, you know, who refuse to buy into the bigotry and the stupidity and the ignorance, and who are very hip in many ways around this new technology and knowing how to use it and are able to make connections that often aren't made, whether we're talking about the Black Lives Movement or we're talking about non-revolution, the Bernie Sanders movement. And I think that where all of this has to really gives us hope is that I really don't believe that there's any hope in the Democratic Party. I mean, I think that the Democratic Party has reached its limits in terms of what it can do. It's the party of finance, and I think that young people are really raising the question, what will politics look like in the 21st century that not only includes our voices and our hopes and our aspirations and our dreams, but reinvents a future that is modeled after a kind of democratic socialism and not after a notion of neoliberalism that parades as democracy. And I think that once we can bring these various social movements together, as crucial as they are, under the umbrella of a radical socialist democracy, I think things will happen. I mean, I think we're seeing it happen. The contradictions are too great, and the assaults are too withering. You know, I mean, it's people are going to lose health care. I mean, people basically are going to find themselves in places they've never found before, because this is an authoritarian regime that has not only separated social costs from any sense of economic activity, but is immersed in the politics of cruelty and a culture of cruelty in which it sees compassion as a liability rather than as an asset. I have more faith in people than I do in that ideology. And I really believe that in the long run, we're going to see massive movements over the next 4 years emerging that give us a sense of hope and give us a sense of possibility.
Well, given the duopoly that we have, it's hard, Enos, and we know that third parties just don't make it, that the game is rigged against it, and you end up voting for the person who does you more harm than good because of the way the system is rigged, as has happened a couple of times with Nader in Florida and then recently with Jill Stein.
Yeah, but I'm not really arguing that route.
I'm arguing
something very different. I'm saying you have to have a long-term strategy. You have to have a short-term strategy. You have to have one foot in and one foot out. And we push the Democratic Party as far as it can go in order to make sure that gains can be made that give people a touch and a glimpse of what would be possible outside of the Democratic Party. At the same time, you begin the long march through the institutions, the long-term organizing that's going to have to take place at community levels around incarceration, around questions of public education, around the questions of the public good. It looks bleak when you put it that way because we don't really have a language that really embodies the kind of democratic struggles that we're talking about. And that language is in the midst of being reinvented. So, you know, I don't believe the White House is going to be charged tomorrow and everything is going to be changed. I'm not a romanticist in that sense. But I do believe that we have already seen models historically in Spain and Portugal and other places where the unimaginable actually happened when social movements and labor movements and the new media and young people came together to reinvent a very different kind of politics.
There's no
reason why it can't happen in the United States.
Right. But what I was about to say was that the Democratic Party is an empty shell. They're having a crisis of fundraising. The Republicans are making money hand over fist. Nobody's donating to the Democratic Party. They're in a state of crisis. My sense is that if the Tea Party can take over the Republican Party, then the kind of people that you're talking about can take over this empty shell known as the Democratic Party.
I hope not.
Well, then how else do you express yourself in a duopoly?
Oh, actually, wait, maybe I missed that. I mean, you're actually suggesting that a left version of the Tea Party could take over the Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly,
is that right?
Because it's an empty shell.
I think that I actually think that's one possibility, and I think it's an important possibility. But I think if they do take it over, they can't just simply restructure it. They've got to reinvent it around a vision that's very different from the Republican Party, the Democratic Party that we have now, right?
Of course. That's the whole point.
I am certainly not against that route. Believe me, you know, it's not just simply thunder or nothing, lightning and thunder or nothing else. I mean, I think whatever route we can use to be able to bring these groups together to develop a political formation that offers a real alternative language and challenge to this idiocy that we have now. Ian, it's going to get worse. I mean, this guy just jumps from one catastrophe to the next. And I think it's like you said at the beginning here of this conversation, you know, people the other night in Phoenix were walking out. Right. They got tired, right?
Yeah.
They're getting tired of this, the emptiness, the shallowness, the lies, the stupidity.
Right.
I mean, how much further can we go with this?
Right.
I mean, what degree does some of the claim to legitimacy have to take root, and where's it going to come from?
Right. Well, you know, it's an amazing situation that the United States, the leader of the free world, is a reality TV star, a racist, a bigot, a con artist, a delusional sociopath. It's just breathtaking that it's happened.
It's breathtaking.
And we all have to do what we can to undo this travesty. Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian, anytime.
And again, Abby, speak with Henry Giroux, the world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy, and he writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the Secretary of Interior's plans to review 27 national monuments ordered by President Trump. What's my name? What's my
my station. Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Keiter, who is the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, University Distinguished Professor and Founding Director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land, Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He serves as a trustee of the National Parks Conservation Association and the Rocky Mountain Mineral Law Foundation, and his books include Keeping Faith with Nature, Ecosystems, Democracy, and America's Public Lands, Reclaiming the Native Home of Hope, Community, Ecology, and the West, and his latest book is To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Keiter.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke, is expected to issue today a change in the way that national monuments are protected in this country. And apparently, the 27 national monuments could well be in jeopardy. They're being reviewed. But I guess the bottom line here is that no president has ever abolished a national monument designated by a predecessor until now. And what is the latest?
As I understand it, the secretary has issued a report to President Trump, who initially asked for such a report reviewing these 27 national monuments. The news thus far suggests that he has not recommended the abolishment of any of the monuments, but he is recommending revision of the size of, quote, a handful of monuments. That's all we know at this point in time.
But what would that mean in practical sense? I mean, because my understanding is that there's a possibility of mining and drilling, not to mention the intrusion of recreation, camping, hunting, shooting, etc. So walk us through the possibilities of what reducing national monuments might mean as opposed to abolishing them.
A number of the monuments that are under review were established to protect entire landscapes, and most of them exceed 100,000 acres in size, and some even a million acres in size. And that's really consistent with contemporary views about what's necessary to conserve both natural and cultural resources, particularly in the instance of the Bears Ears National Monument in southeastern Utah. If there's a significant reduction in size of any of these monuments, it will likely impact the resources that were originally protected, again, whether those are natural or cultural. So some degree of wildlife or biodiversity or Indian cultural artifacts or that sort of thing may be left out of the revised boundaries.
So how much, then, are we, those Americans who care about the their environment and their heritage, and I know the word heritage is being used a lot lately by the president, but essentially, you know, you have to go back to President Theodore Roosevelt and the Antiquities Act, which was signed in 1906. That's the foundation of our protection, right?
You're correct. It is the Antiquities Act of 1906 that provided the president with authority to establish national monuments. And just about every president since Theodore Roosevelt has exercised that authority to protect a substantial amount of acreage across the nation. And I probably should note that a number of originally declared national monuments have been converted eventually by Congress into national parks. A couple examples are the Grand Canyon and Olympic National Park in the state of Washington.
So what would be the difference then between a national monument and a national park?
Up until recently, not much difference, because the National Park Service has had responsibility for national monuments. But beginning in the mid-1990s, with President Clinton's establishment of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah, responsibility for managing that monument was given to the Bureau of Land Management. And since then, a substantial number of newly declared national monuments have been left with the original managing agency, which could be and has been the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service. So you have virtually all of the four major federal land management agencies now responsible for some national monuments. Ultimately, the management standards for these monuments are set under the proclamation that the president issues establishing them. And the principal feature of those proclamations has been a withdrawal of the lands from any sort of industrial activity, such as mining or oil and gas exploration.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Kider, who is the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, University Distinguished Professor, and Founding Director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land, Resources, and the Environment at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He serves as a trustee of the National Park Conservation Association and the Rocky Mountain Mineral Law Foundation, and his books include Keeping Faith with Nature, Ecosystems, Democracy, and America's Public Lands, Reclaiming the Native Home of Hope, Community Ecology, and the West, and his latest book is To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea. So, as somebody that has spent your career both studying the national parks and national monuments and actively trying to preserve these extraordinary national treasures, what has changed lately? I mean, it does seem to be that this is different. I mean, first of all, what kind of qualifications does Ryan Zinke have to be the Secretary of the Interior? Not that a president doesn't have a right to appoint whoever he wants, but my understanding is that most of the former Secretaries of the Interior have been, you know, conservationists. Perhaps James Watt might have been an exception, but by and large, that seems to be their outlook. In terms of recent Secretaries of the Interior, would you compare Ryan Zinke?
I think we're just getting familiar with Secretary Zinke and the role that he will play in that position, but it is noteworthy that this review that he has precipitated, again with the president's direction, is unprecedented in the history of the public lands. It simply hasn't happened before. There have been a few instances in the past of generally relatively modest revisions of national monument boundaries, usually to correct errors in the original mapping of those sites, but nothing at the level or scale of this review. And of course, we don't know exactly what's being recommended at this point, but over the long haul, if this president proceeds to significantly alter boundaries of a number of national monuments, it really opens the door for sort of a yo-yo approach to national monuments as we move forward, especially given the sort of partisan political factors that seem to be playing into this review. The president has issued executive orders promoting energy development on the public lands. There's real concern that that's one of the underlying motivations for the monument review to open lands that were taken off the board for oil and gas and other energy development to make them available moving forward. So we'll wait and see ultimately what the Zinke tenure, how it plays out. But in terms of conservation and being sensitive to the various array of resources on the public lands, including wildlife and recreation and simply scenic beauty and archaeological treasures, I would say that he's not off to a sterling start at this point.
But is it possible, since Donald Trump asked for this review, that this could end up being a part of what appears to be the president's obsession, or certainly his track record, that anything that Obama did, he wants to undo?
It is possible that this will play out in that manner. Certainly, several of the 27 national monuments under review were established by President Obama. And we don't know at this point if he's targeted those monuments, but some of the early press reports suggest that some of the Obama monuments are being recommended for reduction. And, of course, we'll have to wait and see what the president does. At some point, we'll learn what the secretary's recommendations are, and then we'll see how the president responds to that. He could accept them, he could reject them, he could take action, or perhaps not take action.
Well, already you mentioned the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument that President Clinton made a national monument. That stopped a proposed coal project, the Smoky Hollow Mine, at the time. So, in other words, that project could be back on if that's undone.
That is a possibility. If that where the mine would have been located or could have been located is excluded from the monument boundaries. Interesting that you mentioned the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, because following the establishment of that monument, Congress actually passed legislation authorizing a major land exchange between the federal government and the state of Utah that involved nearly 200,000 acres, the federal government acquiring state land, and then the state acquiring nearly 200,000 acres of federal land that involved mineral leases or coal and other energy minerals that the state has proceeded to develop, along with a $50 million payment. And it is likely that if that arrangement may have to be unwound in order for a reduction in the size of the monument to occur.
Well, we know that President Trump is a big champion of coal. So if this could be a 1-2 punch, right? One, he gets rid of something that Obama did, and two, he brings back coal.
That is possible, although a number of people knowledgeable about the mine proposal have raised questions as to whether it is ultimately economically viable. And, of course, coal, given the concerns about climate change these days, has not been faring well among the fossil fuels, with natural gas prices where they are and the abundance of gas available today. So I think we'd have to see if anybody really wants to proceed to establish a coal mine in this remote region where there'd be some difficulty in moving the coal to market.
So let's walk through some of the legal processes that will likely ensue any efforts on the part of either the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke's move on at the behest of President Trump to limit the size of 27 national monuments. For example, I mean, I assume that there'll be a blizzard of lawsuits, right?
I think that is a correct assumption. And the legal question is basically whether the president has the authority to do this, that is to rescind if he does, or more likely modify the size of some of these national monuments. The Antiquities Act of 1906 gives the president authority to create national monuments or establish them, but it's absolutely silent on the question of whether he can subsequently modify or rescind them. And no court has yet had occasion to rule on that particular question, because some of these early boundary modifications were never challenged in court. Since the Antiquities Act was adopted, Congress adopted the what's called the Federal Land Policy and Management Act in 1976, and it very expressly says that the Secretary of the Interior does not have any authority to modify or revoke a national monument designation. It's silent as to the president. However, the legislative history accompanying that law indicated that Congress intended to reserve for itself the authority to rescind or modify national monuments. So you can see the legal arguments that are lurking there, that although the Antiquities Act might be silent, Congress has ultimately clarified its intent that the president did not have this authority.
But as a lawyer yourself, Robert Kider, are you confident that the issue of precedent here will be strong enough?
Well, in terms of precedent, again, there isn't precedent on this
right,
particular
question. Right, well, I mean, I'm suggesting precedent in the other sense, that this has never been done before. So,
Well, it's also worth noting that since the early 1960s, no president has taken any action to modify or revoke a national monument. So since the adoption of this 1976 Policy Management Act, we simply don't have any instances of presidents taking action or any judicial test of how that language might cut in this particular issue. In terms of how the courts will deal with it, it's always a little bit risky to predict. A court that looks broadly at congressional intent would probably have some difficulty with recognizing that the president has this sort of authority, especially in light of this 1976 legislation. A court that's only focused on the Antiquities Act and the silence that's found there might feel a little freer to give the president a little freer rein in this area.
So this is not the kind of thing that's going to end up in the Supreme Court?
I would say that there is at least I will go so far as to say a good likelihood that it could end up in the Supreme Court, given the national interest that's involved in this particular issue and the fact that the legal issue itself simply has not been resolved or even addressed at this point in the lower courts.
Well, then we find out whether conservative and the word conserve go together, right?
We might well find that out, although at the same time, we'll have to take a look at how the justices regard the question of statutory interpretation and the role that legislative history and subsequent legislation plays in interpreting a law like the 110-year-old Antiquities Act.
Well, Robert Kider, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Kider, who is the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, University Distinguished Professor, and Founding Director of the Wallace Stegner Center for Land, Resources, and the Environment at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He serves as a trustee of the National Parks Conservation Association and the Rocky Mountain Mineral Law Foundation, and his books include Keeping Faith with Nature, Ecosystems, Democracy, and America's Public Lands, Reclaiming the Native Home of Hope, Community Ecology and the West, and his latest book is To Conserve Unimpaired, The Evolution of the National Park Idea. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.